Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left Restaurant and now Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. And now you can download our podcast through iTunes.
And just in case you don't know what Mark's talking about with this whole podcasting thing, it's great to hear us live on the radio, and we love to keep you company between 11 and noon. But you can go to these podcasting sites, or you can go to our website and find old shows and listen to them, because some of you came in late in the game, and you can get the reruns at will. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great.
Well.
Doing great. I'm not in construction anymore. Yippee!
The word is out. Mark and I have traded in our construction hard hats for actual restaurant.
Although I did like the cool little light on the top of it.
That's a miner hat, by the way, and we weren't mining. Catherine Lombardi Restaurant is now open in downtown New Brunswick. The reason we bring this up is not as an advertisement, though it is a bit of a shameless plug. But we've really changed from construction mode into restaurant mode, and running a new restaurant is very exciting. And you really are a jack of all trades, but I like it a heck of a lot better than managing a construction site.
Yippee!
'Cause I'm good at this. I'm actually good at this. But the things that amaze me, now we've put almost $2 million.
It's not even that we're good at it, Francis. It's that we know how to fix the problems.
Exactly.
And there are problems. It's a brand new restaurant. We have a lot of work to do before we get it to where we want it to
be. I didn't say the restaurant was good yet. I said we just opened, and we don't have a sign that says we're open. We sort of snuck downstairs last Monday and opened the doors. So if you really would like to come out and have a perfect meal, try another restaurant. Come to
Stage
Catherine Lombardi.
Left is fantastic. You might want to go
to another restaurant in town. Catherine Lombardi will be great in about a month. The food is great and the room is beautiful, but what amazes me is no matter how well you plan, if you do an original space, and this is why I think corporations can save so much money, because if you have a standard space that you build a million times in a million places.
Right, and it's identical in square footage and, you know, this is 4 feet from this and this is 3 feet from this and this is 2 feet from this.
Both of our restaurants are in a 1925 building. That's a weird sort of triangular shape.
I've elected to open a restaurant in a triangle. If anybody thinks that's a good idea.
It's horrible, and you get all these weird angles, these like shark tooth rooms.
Slice it, put it just for fun. Just go home and put a diagonal piece of tape in one of your rooms and try and rearrange your furniture.
Right, let's figure out where to put the couch. Anyway, and the bookshelf and the television, because you're always looking off at 45 degrees. Anyway, the things that amaze me are, we spent close to $2 million, right? And the restaurant is beautiful, but you know, there's that one place where the light didn't go.
Right.
We got to put in two more lights. You know what I mean?
The one I love is the light that just goes to nowhere.
Yeah, that points on nothing.
You're shining up the back of a couch.
Because we moved something during construction but didn't move the light. Yeah, that's got to change. The other thing we do is, you know, you spend $2 million and you put the electrical outlet exactly 1 foot further away from the appliance you need to plug in. You know what I mean? And you spent $2 million.
Well, because you spent $2 million, but you didn't measure the cord on the espresso machine.
Everything's a heartbreaker.
Yeah,
everything's a heartbreaker.
You know, so it's tugging on the espresso machine, hoping that it will just grow an extra 12 inches.
And my favorite story of all, and the thing about when you open a restaurant is regulated as a general assembly use, which means that the fire codes are stricter because you have, you know, in an office building, in a private home, you have one set of standards. In an office building that the public is going to be in, you have another set of standards. In what's called a general assembly use, which is a restaurant or a theater, you have an even higher level of standards. And that's valid, but it's also expensive and it's also a pain. And on a second floor restaurant, and Catherine Lombardi is on the second floor, it's even higher. So Mark and I got into the first argument. We went through this year-long project without one, F-U argument. And it finally happened day before yesterday.
About whether a set of curtains should be drawn or not drawn. We're not saying that the curtains should have been there or not been there. We're not saying anything.
We built 10,000 square feet of restaurant without much of a crossword.
Knock down, drag out.
This was like, this you, was.
You're an idiot. You're an idiot.
This was the, it's escalating in front of the staff. We're going to go outside and go for a walk. All right. So we finally get done with this ridiculous argument. And we walked in yesterday morning. And our third partner, Lou, was there. And he's like, yeah, fire inspector was in this morning. Has to take the curtains down.
No curtains here. Can't have them.
It's a fire exit. That was God just telling us to
behave. Yeah, it's God telling you and me to shut up.
I will always remember the when we opened Old Vines, we ran a wine shop for a while, which we then, the demand for stage left restaurant became so great that
my
we made
a wine shop was
room.
Eaten by my restaurant.
So we opened Old Vines and we had a sign out in front of the storefront that said Old Vines Wine Shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember I was walking into work, and this was something that we didn't do wrong, but it was a guy, an old guy, an old New Brunswick guy, I see him on the streets every day, was just looking up at the sign with his mouth agape. And so I sort of sidled up next to him, and I was looking up at the sign, my cup of Dunkin' Donuts coffee in my hand, with my mouth agape, and I said, what you looking at? He said, I can't believe it. They spelled it wrong. I said, what do you mean? He said, Old Wines. They spelled it wrong. And you know what I said? Oh, my God. I'm going to go tell him. No, it was old.
Just so everyone gets inside our heads, Old Vines, we believe, tend to make the greatest grapes. They make fewer grapes. Tend to make the greatest grapes.
It wasn't a misspelled sign.
No,
Old
it
Vines.
Wasn't. So just a quick story about our latest construction foibles.
Yeah.
We still don't have draft beer in the new restaurant. You know, we're open for 4 or 5 days. Still can't get draft beer in the new restaurant. So I'm dealing with this company. And I call the guy. I'm like, listen, you told me you're going to be here at 8 a.m. yesterday to get in. And the guy goes, oh, you talked to Joey C. See, I'm Joey S. So, I do the best I can here. But Joey C, you talk to Joey C. He's the guy. And so I've started referring to these two gentlemen as Joey Supersod and Joey Capicol, because they are two Italian pork products.
See, you can do that because you're Italian. See me? But I'm going to get punched in the face if I do something like that.
But Joey S. says to me, oh, yeah, we got to install that tomorrow.
Because why?
You do? Joey C. told me you could. Yeah, well, I'm Joey S. You could tell me the difference between us because I'm the good-looking one. Joey S? Yeah? I'm talking to you on the phone.
How do I know what you look like? You big gabagool, you.
That was close. That was almost right.
I gotta tell you, there's a place in Jersey City near my house that is just a place. That's all I'll say. And it's a place that serves food or something like it. And it's called Gabagools.
Gabagool.
G-A-B-A-G-O-O-L-Z.
That's hysterical.
Gabagools.
By the way, if anybody has heard The Sopranos or whatever say Gabagool, that word starts with a C. Okay?
It does start with a C.
Capicola.
Yeah, I mean, all this
American.
Italian stuff I'm learning, operating your family's restaurant, I'm learning about, like, Gumare, you know?
Yeah.
Starts with a C?
Starts with a C. That's definitely a C. Sorry.
The other thing I love is the Italians who speak Italian come to the restaurant and talk to the Italian Americans who, like, imitate their grandmother's Italian, and it's slightly different, and you all have arguments about how to pronounce stuff.
Most of us are wrong.
For an Irishman, that's really an interesting thing to watch. All I have to worry about is spelling mistakes. Anyway, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We have a guest coming up. A gentleman named Peter Schleimer will be joining us by telephone from Austria to talk to us about Austrian food, wine, and the Michelin Guide, and a flock of birds that is attacking Austrian grapes. My heavens. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
3.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey,
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today we have a special guest joining us. Peter Schleimer writes for the Austrian publication Vinaria. He writes about and reviews wines and also restaurants in his native Austria and works with American importer Terry Fies, sending some of the finest Austrian wine right here to us in the United States. He's our house expert on wine and all things Austrian. He joins us from his home outside Vienna to talk with us about the burgeoning culinary and enological love affair between our two countries. Hi there, Peter. Welcome back to the show.
Peter, welcome back.
Hello. Good evening. Good evening in Austria.
My, good your evening.
Good
day here.
Good morning in the States. It's great to be here with you.
Well, vicariously anyway, or through the telephone lines. Hey,
yeah.
Peter, this call, not that I need a reason to call you, but in the spirit of full disclosure, Peter and Mark and I are old friends. But this call came about because I read an AP article that was based out of Eisenstadt, Austria, and I want to read from it. It says, giant flocks of hungry starlings have descended upon vineyards in eastern Austria in scenes reminiscent of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, a vintner told the Austrian media on Wednesday. The birds come every year in Burgenland, but this year the flocks are much larger than usual, said vintner Walter Kernbauer. The birds attack every morning. It's like the Hitchcock movie, he was quoted as saying by the Associated Press.
I read this. I was afraid for your life, Peter.
I love this. I love this. It said, Kernbauer was not available for comment to the Associated Press as he was out in the fields dealing with the birds, an employee said. What's going on, Peter?
Well, a short explanation. I mean, this is a problem we have every year, and it's actually regional problem, which is typical of the way eastern part of Austria, where it borders Hungary, and that's where you have a warmer climate. You have a very large population of various birds, and so you have a lot of hungry birds there too.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is that in the northern part of the Burgenland, the province is called Burgenland. The growers have had these problems viciously, you know, fighting the birds for many, many years. And Mr. Kirnbauer, who is located in the center of Burgenland, was kind of not expecting. He's not, you know, he's had these problems, but not
to this degree.
Not in a weird way, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this year it's been really bad. So they have been totally surprised and kind of frightened by the flocks of birds that descended over the vineyards.
So, Peter, I would expect that a grape fattened bird is very tasty. Why is this still a problem?
On Austrian menus everywhere, this starling special is very cheap. Yeah, what do they do? I mean, are starlings good eaten? Is there a way to they should go out and shoot them?
Well, that's what they used to do, actually. But a few years ago, they were put under protection, so you're in fact not allowed to hunt them, which is a certain problem. I mean, nowadays they use kind of shooting machines, which kind of just, you know, give a loud bang every few minutes. But the birds, you know, they get really used to them. They're not stupid. They, you know, they love the grape diet. They love the sweet grapes, especially.
Yeah. Francis tried the same thing with me for a while, and it didn't work. I kept coming back.
Right by the cellar. Bang! It worked for like a month.
What was that? Ah!
Well, now, just so we know what kind of stuff we're talking about, this isn't silly. The starling feasting on grapes meant to become Burgenland wines have caused damage this year estimated between $96,000 and $120,000 to Kernbauer, he said. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. It's a battle, you know, they're fighting a losing battle in, mm-hmm. in reality. There's very little you can do. There's one pretty safe method, which is putting nets over the rows of vines. So you kind of, but this is extremely work intensive, and it's of course expensive too. You have to get these very fine meshed nets to put over every row of vines, you know, and if you have something like, I don't know, 20 or 30 hectares of vines, it's a great deal of work you have to put into it.
And a hectare is about 2.2 acres, so that's a lot of land to cover.
And then when you have to tend to your grapes or do pruning or do anything like that, you've got to deal with the nets as well.
Exactly, yeah. It hinders you in your work, and on the other hand, you know, it's it's extremely work intensive to put them up too. So
I have this vision in my head of Peter Schleimer stuck in a bird net in a Bergenland vineyard.
Hey, did you see me last week?
Like being stuck in a fairy ring. So let's broaden the conversation a little bit, though, Peter. I mean, I know we've talked before. You were one of the first guests on our show, but we can retread that issue. It's been it's been long enough in the past. I've even taken you off the archives. We'll get you back on again now. Now we see a lot of Austrian wine in the United States over the last 10 years or so. And I first met you when I first went to Austria, and I guess it was 96, would you say?
Something like 96 or 97, something like that, yeah.
Well, now, Austrian wine prior to that was sort of unheard of, and in the last 10 years it's come to be, I mean, if you don't have Austrian wine on your list, you're not cool. All the cool kids are drinking Austrian wine. How did that happen? How did you guys invade the American market so quickly and become, you know, de rigueur of any serious wine restaurant?
I think the main reason is that we just have extremely interesting varieties. You know, we have stuff other countries don't have, and that's the secret. You know, we don't, Chardonnay is not a big thing for us. Cabernet Sauvignon is also a very small thing for us. We have grape varieties that are just, first of all, unique, and second of all, interesting too. It doesn't help if they're only unique and the wines suck. So,
Yeah, that's very different.
Well, I think one of the things about the Austrian wines is how food friendly they are, and how food friendly they are with foods that are not usually friendly to wine. You know, so there's Grüner Veltliner with salads and vegetables happens to be a very good mix.
I want to talk more about specific varieties of wines, and maybe we can tell our listeners some things they can look for out there. We have a big wine Austrian selection on our list on both our restaurants. But there are more and more affordable Austrian wines out there. We'll be talking more with Peter Schleimer, Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer from Vinaria magazine from his home outside Vienna in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Austrian wine expert and restaurant critic Peter Schleimer, who joins us from his home in Austria to talk with us about Austrian wines in general. You said before the break, Peter, that you have things that other people don't have, meaning Austrian wines offer things that other places don't have. Like what?
Well, our number one grape by far in quantity and often, even in quality, is a grape called Grüner Veltliner. And it is a white grape that produces beautiful wines with quite a bit of spice. And the fascinating thing about this grape is that it's its versatility. So, you know, you can get wines that are rather light-bodied, that are just, you know, fresh and slug them down, beautiful wines. And you can get extremely ripe, concentrated wines that are full-bodied and with a great structure. So,
and some of those higher-end wines really do last a long time. I mean, we have a number of them in our cellar.
They age and age, yeah.
Yeah, they age extremely well. I mean, it's amazing. I'm the lucky person because sitting in Austria and being a wine critic, I have, in fact, had wines back to the 1930s. From this grape, and they were from Nikolaihof in this case, and it was just, you know, I was sitting there, oh, I can't believe it. You know, it was so young.
I think it was the genesis of our friendship is that when I went to Austria, I went with about seven other American wine buyers in 96, I believe it was, and Peter was our host, and with a person who was showing us around, and actually the Austrian government had brought us over. And we tasted some of these old wines, and the wine-producing regions of Austria were occupied by Germany and then occupied by Russia, and a lot of the wines were stolen. A lot of these great old wines were family treasures that were hidden, in some cases thrown into lakes, so they would sink to the bottom of the lake and be preserved and then dug up years after the war. And these people were so kind to open some of these pre-war bottles for us, and I got to have them sitting at a table with Peter so many years ago, and they're mind-boggling that something would last that long. I mean, were there a lot of stories of people who hid wine from the Nazis and then from the Russians as well?
Well, sadly, not many of these secret wine depots survived. The Russians were pretty good at finding out, you know, where a new wall had been set up or a hole had been dug, and, you know, where the people hid their wines. And they actually, at that time, they went through the cellars and either drank it all, or if they couldn't drink it anymore, they just kind of used their machine guns and shot at the barrels and all
that's
the wine
incredible.
Was wasted.
Isn't Nikolai Hof a house that was occupied by the Russians and then the Nikolai Hofs bought it back? Is that the, did I get that right?
They did have Russians in there. There was some you know minor commander in there, but they received it back. I mean, it was not a problem afterwards.
Our guest is Peter Schleimer. He's an Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer, and we're going to be talking more with him after the news about Austrian wine, about restaurants and Austrian food in America, and how one of the top Michelin Guide restaurants in New York is actually an Austrian restaurant. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're going to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 to noon or just through restaurantguysradio.com or podcast our shows on iTunes.
Today our guest is Peter Schleimer. Peter is an Austrian food journalist, restaurant reviewer, and wine writer. He writes for the Austrian publication Vinaria. He writes about and reviews wines and also restaurants in his native country, and also works with the American importer Terry Fies, sending some of the finest Austrian wines right here to us in the United States. He's our house expert on Austrian wine and all things Austrian, and he joins us from his home outside Vienna to talk with us about the burgeoning culinary and enological love affair between our two countries. Hi there again, Peter.
Hello.
So, Peter, did you see, is it big news out there that the Michelin Guide, which is the preeminent guide or restaurant guide in Europe, has started to review for the first time an American city, the Michelin Guide to New York came out. Has that made the news over there?
I've heard about it, yeah.
Can you tell us how important the Michelin Guide is in Europe?
Well, the Michelin Guide is certainly, it's you could almost say it's the father of all guides. It would be the most respected of all guides.
Yeah, I mean, having traveled through Europe, even though there are some other guides out there, Guide Michelin, Go Michelin.
Guide Michelin.
No, Guide Michelin and
Gomio
is what I was trying to say. Thanks very much for your help.
You
really
know, Mark,
appreciate
actually,
it, gentlemen.
The
way to be there for me.
Funny thing is, Mark actually speaks French.
I just can't speak is the problem. That's nothing to do with language. It is, but definitely. I mean, Michelin has been there forever, and is the one that everybody looks to.
It's been described as incorruptible, and we even had there was a book written about
which in France is a statement.
Yeah, exactly. Because everything's corruptible in France, and then the Michelin reviewers don't even go on strike. The Michelin Guide just came out, and here's an interesting thing. In the New York Guide, now, 3 stars in the Michelin Guide is the highest honor that you can get. And it's really, to be a 3-star restaurant, it's incredible. New York now boasts 4 3-star restaurants and 4 2-star restaurants. That's the eight top restaurants in New York, according to the Michelin Guide, which is the preeminent international guide to restaurants. And one of the 2 stars, which means one of the top 8 restaurants in New York City, is Danube, which is an Austrian or Austrian-inspired restaurant. How crazy is that, huh, Peter?
All that wiener schnitzel. I mean,
now, Peter, you and I have eaten at Danube on several occasions, and I remember at least the beginnings of most of those meals. And isn't it odd? I mean, I wouldn't think that I would have, you know, we have 3 Austrian restaurants in New York that matter right now. We have Thor, we have Valse, and we have Danube. 10 years ago, I if you said, where do I go for Austrian food, I couldn't have thought of a place.
Yes, you could have. Austria. How about Vienna? We'll see you soon.
So what is this Austrian invasion going on of American restaurant scene, Peter? What do you think is behind it?
Well, I just think, you know, Austria has, over the last 2 decades, come to realize, you know, its own qualities and has started to bring these qualities in culinary and enophile sense to other countries. I think, you know, it's a matter of kind of realizing how good stuff you have at home, and the stuff we have here is really good. I mean, the food and the wine is really remarkable. It's unique, and that's why this is happening, to my mind.
And by the way, anybody looking for a great place to travel and visit, obviously the skiing is spectacular in Austria, but the people are unbelievable. The countryside is unbelievable. It's just that the food is unbelievable. It is a great place to go and visit. One of my favorite countries in the world.
The last time I was there with Peter, you took me to a church which is actually in the city of Vienna, the Kloster Neuburg, which actually has been making wine for how long have they been making wine there, Peter? Forever, right?
12th century.
Yeah, you know, recent newcomers.
Yeah.
but the Kloster Neuburg is a very old building. They've been making wine. It's actually in the city limits of Vienna, and you can go, and if you go and purchase wine there, they have some older vintages available. And the remarkable thing about Austrian wines is that they do age, and these older vintages are often available. And there was an okay selection of older vintages available in the little shop around, and we got to talking to one of the people, and then I dropped Peter Schleimer's name, and then even older vintages became available, which I really like. But which is the only reason I hang out with you, Peter, when I'm in Austria, because he's a terrible bore, everyone. But we went up and I took a tour of the Kloster with Peter, and the woman, and you know, Germans and Austrians have a reputation in America being a little, you know, rigid or terse sometimes. And there was a woman who was giving the tour, and she said, she showed me a particular piece of stained glass, which is one of the oldest pieces of stained glass in Europe. And she said something like, they said, now how old is that piece of glass? And she said, that glass is 400 years older than your country.
I remember that one. Yeah, that was great.
And I thought, and I felt scolded like a schoolboy. And I, you know,
it looks like a schoolboy. That
but they gave me a glass of Grunewald later and everything was okay.
Yeah, the Austrians do loosen up after a couple of glasses of wine. No doubt
and
about.
So does France. Now, there has been a real resurgence. I think an interesting thing about Austrian wine culture is there were some scandals that, in a way, the silver lining to that to the cloud of some scandals was the renaissance of Austrian wine quality. What happened with the scandals there, Peter?
Well, in short, it was. It actually had to do with low quality, low price wines, and there was a lot of pressure on some big producers to produce wines at lower and lower price levels, but with residual sugar and so on. So some people came up with the fantastic idea of putting something akin to antifreeze into, which tastes sweet, into the wines to sweeten them up.
Let's not do that, okay, Peter? can we stop that?
Okay, so some unscrupulous producers put antifreeze into their inexpensive wine, and they got found out.
They got found out. Yeah, it was the Austrian press kind of went ravaged over the whole thing and
good.
I was just saying,
good for the Austrian press.
Can't really blame them, Peter.
And then
it was a good thing. You know, for me, it was all positive because we would never be where we are today if the scandal hadn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the most interesting thing. What happened as a result after the scandal? How did the Austrian wine industry? I mean, I think that's why I got invited to go to Austria, on the Austrian government.
Sure, so we would believe in the wines again.
But what happened as a result of the fallout from that scandal?
Well, exports went probably down to something like 3% of what they had been. It was really terrible for many growers, and it was 99.99% of the growers were honest and never touched this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it was due to, I think all in all it was something like 7 or 8 people who were put in jail for this. So it was really a tiny number of producers, and the exports literally went to zero, and everybody had a really hard time. But the Austrian growers didn't fall down and cry over what had happened. They just kind of, I don't know, they were electrified. They tried everything to just reach higher and higher quality levels, and they were very successful. I think the the things that have been going on in Austria, as I say, were really, really remarkable.
I've seen some huge changes in Austrian wine in the last 10 years. Well, it's no longer just the top producers that are making great wine.
There are
a lot of producers.
Point.
Well, I also think there had to be a market shakeout from when your exports go down to zero. Anybody who was weak or who was under suspicion at all had to fall off the radar. And if you wanted to survive at all, you had to be great. Hey, listen, our guest today is Peter Schleimer. He is an Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer, and we're talking to him from his home outside Vienna about Austrian wine and Austrian restaurants in America. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott from Stage Left Restaurant and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant, both in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Peter Schleimer. He joins us from his home in Austria, where he is a noted restaurant critic and wine writer. Now, we've been talking about wines, Peter. Let's talk about restaurants. You're a restaurant critic, and actually, you've taken me reviewing restaurants with you, which is great, especially since your magazine paid for my dinner.
Big super. Fun. Big fun going restaurant reviewing and having someone else pay for it. Love it.
That's super.
Glad I don't have to do it six nights a week. Now, love doing it, everyone. Once in a while.
Now, we've also we've dined together at Danube, which is a restaurant that received 2 Michelin stars in New York and the first ever Michelin guide in New York. And we had some great meals there. Is that Austrian food or is that a derivative of Austrian food?
That's an interesting question.
That's because I'm putting him on the spot, and he's afraid if he says the wrong thing.
You were going to ask that. No.
And Peter does not want to be banned from Danube.
Right? Peter wants to get a reservation. So tell us.
No, they do certainly have a large variety of really typical Austrian food. I mean, they have a great Wiener Schnitzel, for example. It's really, really good. It's even I mean, and if I say this, don't misunderstand, but if I say it's even really, really good by Austrian standards,
yeah,
you know, I mean, we think that we make the best food, you know, that is Austrian,
right,
in any case. But that is, so they have a large variety of that stuff. Of course, they kind of fusion it with some things that are not as Austrian. For example, I've had octopus there, and that would not be a typical Austrian.
Not a lot of octopus in Austria?
No, not a lot. We lost our last seaport in, I think, 1918.
Yeah, I was going to say, those mountain rivers, they don't produce a lot of octopus for you?
Oh, no.
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting, one of the things, Peter, that we're wrestling with, we're opening this Italian-American restaurant, and we talk about all the time, and people may not realize this in the United States. When you go to a restaurant, you go to a Chinese restaurant or an Italian restaurant, those almost never, if they're good restaurants, are truly Italian, because to have a great restaurant, you need to source locally. You know, and you can bring in some stuff from abroad, but you need to deal with the food that is where you have it. You can't ship everything in from Italy, let's say. And frankly, if you did, it wouldn't be fresh.
Yeah, we talked with our staff. We said, listen, imported buffalo mozzarella. You know, is that really a good thing?
Right, exactly.
Do I really want my 2-week-old shipped mozzarella from Italy?
Or would I rather have the mozzarella that I make from local milk in that tradition,
right,
made an hour ago? You know, and I think that any restaurant in America faces that. But you don't have that in Austria. I mean, you don't have a lot of Chinese restaurants and Italian restaurants and things like that. Or do you?
Well, actually, we do. I mean, Austria has a strong bondage to Italy, always has had. I mean, the favorite country for holidays is Italy for the Austrians. So we do love the Italian food. But the thing is, we don't have a lot of high-end Italian and Chinese restaurants, especially Chinese. Usually it's just, you know, like noontime menu stuff that is cheap. And
yeah, I got to tell you, in my trips to Austria, I almost always avoid the Chinese restaurants.
Yeah. I avoid them too.
And that's from a professional restaurant critic. Now, you know, what's funny, what's interesting is Ireland is where a lot of my family is from, and most of my cousins who were born in Ireland have returned to Ireland. And I visit them quite often, and there you see all sorts of different ethnic restaurants popping up, much like America, because you have all these expatriates who've returned, and a local food culture that's, well, not the best in Europe, in Ireland. And I think I see, you know, Chinese restaurants and Italian restaurants and so on and so forth opening up in Dublin and even in smaller towns around Ireland, and I think that's that's a very different animal that we deal with here and they deal with there, that when you have a native cuisine and you just have that native cuisine like you do in Austria. Another big thing that you have in Austria that I thought was very remarkable and is that you have a tremendous culture of coffee. And whenever we're there, we have coffee. And now you have Starbucks opening in Vienna. What are you doing? Why are you doing that? Is that going over big?
I'm not. I was actually planning to burn them down. No, not really. But it is. No, it's an anomaly for us. It's just crazy because our coffee culture is amazing, as you know, Francis. And and you know, the thing in a typical Austrian cafe or coffee house is that you can go in there, they have all the newspapers, you can sit in there, you can drink one cup of coffee and sit in there for 2 hours reading a newspaper. It's just great, you know, and this is our culture, you know, comfortable, just lay back, you know, enjoy.
Well, but also the coffee is tremendous. I mean, there's tremendous care put into coffee and tea in Austria. And I think Starbucks is okay, but I think it was just shocking to me to see that Starbucks got any traction at all in
Vienna. That it could possibly overtake
Are people
Viennese
going there?
Coffee.
Well, tourists go there. And some of the young people, you know, I mean, like students or something.
Yeah, young people are always looking for a new place to hang out, something different.
Yeah, but, I mean, Starbucks is not the hip thing, I mean, honestly.
Excellent.
That's good news to us.
Yeah.
All right, Peter, we only have a couple of minutes left, but to be fair to our listeners, I want to give them the name of, say, three Austrian producers that they can look for, that they're likely to find. And Peter
right, maybe,
works,
maybe some of the bigger producers that they can find.
And Peter works as a consolidator for Terry Thies, who's an importer of Austrian and German wines and estate bottled champagnes. And if you see Terry Thies's name on the back label, that's always a good sign. But Peter, give us three producers that you would say that would be most widely available that people could look for to try something interesting and Austrian to drink.
Well, I think one would be an emerging, not only emerging, a star-rocketing estate in Lower Austria, producing mainly white wines, would be Schloss Gobelsberg. They make fantastic Grüne Veltliner. Then for people who like quaffable wines with...
So you know, for most people in the United States, Schloss Gobelsberg is harder to say than Behringer.
We're going to put that on our website. Okay, two more producers.
Okay, for lighter quaffable wines, Walter Glatzer, who is right in the vicinity of Vienna. He makes very good white and red wines. And for sweet wines, I'd go for something like Heidi Schruck.
Heidi Schruck, great wines.
And there you have three.
Thanks, Peter.
Hey, Peter, thank you for joining us and talking to us about all things Austrian today. You've been great.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for being with you.
Okay, take care.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Okay.
Bye-bye. That was Peter Schleimer, Austrian restaurant critic and wine writer and sort of bon vivant man about town. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.